Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
A little piece of cornbread sitting on the shelf.
If you want to sing more, you got to sing it for yourself.
How's everybody doing tonight? Welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on the road and on location at Harding University in beautiful Searcy, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is made possible in part by the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. So how about tonight's music by Tom Alexander and Chuck Hicks? Did y'all like the music? Tom and Chuck have been friends since college and have worked here at Harding University for several decades. They played both the pre-show music, and Chuck is playing for us now. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? When we go on the road, we bring a few pieces of our regular set, which are these amazing screen doors right here and right here. And these are from her Images of the American South collection by Delta artist V.L. Cox. More can be seen at greatfineart.com. We also feature an artist from the area. So tonight's featured artist is Searcy illustrator Hannah Carpenter, with these pieces here behind me, whose custom illustrated portraits for children or pets can be found at little-biscuits.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, all of our storytellers are from Searcy, Arkansas, and they each have decisions to make. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Patrick Garner has not one, but several decisions pending, and we'll end the night with Heath Carpenter, as his decision is both spontaneous and regrettable. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Stephanie Edelman, as a series of events presents a chance to decide in Almost.
It did not rain in the summer of 1998, at least not on the few acres of Arkansas Delta that we called home. On the 4th of July, I sat at my mother-in-law's kitchen table, serving myself some sliced tomatoes and fried okra, thinking about the pecan pie. "After we eat, we need to go check the fields," my husband said. I buttered my ear of corn, nodded, sprinkled it with ground pepper. Out the door, into the pickup, down gravel roads till they turned to dirt. The radio was turned to the local country station, and Tim McGraw sounded loud in the absence of conversation. Dust boiled up around us as he stopped the truck, and we waited, hands on the door latches, for it to settle. The normally rich, dark soil was almost white and loose beneath our feet, like walking through a field of baby powder. The soybeans were only a couple of inches tall, and we could hear them crunch beneath our dusty boots. I wanted to throw up. We didn't look at each other. I prayed for rain. He prayed for rain. We prayed for rain. It did not rain. Sometimes the skies would darken and the wind would blow. We would go out on the back porch and turn our faces up to the black clouds and face the wind, waiting on the rain that was sure to come. But time after time, a few sprinkles would plop down, making small circles in the light brown dust. And then the storm would split and go around us, leaving both our fields and our souls dry and barren. I walked back to the kitchen, thinking about the farm loan and the equipment notes. I'd fall in bed exhausted by worry, only to wake up in the middle of the night with a gasp, my heart racing, unable to go back to sleep. "How hard would it be, God, for you to just make it rain?" I thought. At the yearly family reunion, one of my husband's aunts joked, "You know, the Bible says it rains on the just and the unjust, but they say the hypocrites just don't get any." I did not feel like laughing. The long, hot, dry summer ended in a long, dry fall. Cornfields that were usually gloriously green and towering over me were barely head high. Some of it so stunted by drought that it wasn't worth picking. There ain't nothing here, I heard the combine driver radio to my husband after only one round. We just left the stalk standing in the field, a wilted brown monument to fear and to dying hope. We were able to harvest a little of the corn, a few thousand bushels when there should have been tens of thousands, but the overalled man at the granary said, "Sorry, man, can't take it." We'd never heard the term aflatoxin before, but it's a vocabulary word we'll never forget. It's a disease common in drought situations, and our usual buyers refuse to purchase our infected corn. One Sunday afternoon, my husband drove his loaded truck from granary to granary, a tightness in his body, a dullness in his eyes, desperately trying to find someone who'd buy our corn. I went in the bathroom and closed the door so the kids wouldn't see me and lay curled up on the cold tile floor. It felt like someone had punched me hard in the stomach and my muscles had cramped around the invading fist, refusing to let go. I could not breathe. The sun had set before he made it home. His normally strong shoulders slumped, no smile of greeting. No one would take the corn. No one. He told me that night he'd parked his grain truck in line with the other farmers, their fates in the hands of grain buyers, and stood listening to an old man cry. He'd planted every acre in corn. It was all diseased. He'd had several bad years in a row. He would lose his farm. The next day, I said to my mother that I didn't know what good it did to pray. God was just going to do to you whatever he wanted to anyway. Her eyes grew big and round, and a quick hand covered her mouth, but what could she say? I sat in the creaky office chair, looking at our bank statement, and thought, I need to get a job. But what I wanted to do was to go back to college. I'd been a straight-A student in high school, but the thought of leaving home and going off to a university had been too frightening. Not because I didn't think I could handle the academics, but because I was fearful of what I might encounter out there in the big, wide world. I'd been warned about those godless academics who'd gotten so smart they lost their faith. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, for it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness, the preachers had quoted. When I could push worry aside, I pictured myself in class with my hand raised. I pictured stacks of books, one open in my lap, a pencil behind my ear. I saw that framed diploma on the wall. I'd begun to think about it almost compulsively, but going back to school seemed impossible. Three kids at home and a disastrous year of farming behind us, a husband struggling with the effects of a drought that had dried up more than soybeans and corn. There was laundry to be done and floors to be vacuumed, ball games and PTA meetings to attend, and how in the world would we pay for it? We'd made it through that drought year, but we had not fully recovered. I kept the thought of school safely in the dark recesses of my mind, a precious jewel folded into black velvet that I could take out and examine only when alone. Why do I have such a strong desire to go back to school if it's impossible, God? If I shouldn't? Then the guilt again, because I fully realized that I had a loving husband and three healthy children and that I was supposed to be a keeper at home. It must be wrong to want more than that, right? Another reason for stomach cramps and sleepless nights. Another reason to question God. Minor emergencies are a regular part of farming, especially during planting and harvest. Ripened crops wait for no man, and my husband needed a part for his combine that wasn't in stock at the local John Deere dealership. We were going to drive to Jonesboro to pick it up, and our oldest son, a junior in high school at the time, asked us to stop by Arkansas State University and pick up a school catalog for him while we were there. We drove around the campus, finally finding a place to park that we hoped wouldn't result in a ticket on the windshield, and set off on foot. The day was cool, the kind of autumn day that always makes me feel as if I should be buying a plaid book satchel and a new lunchbox, a pleated dress and saddle oxfords for the first day of school. We walked down a tree-lined sidewalk, meeting students wearing faded jeans and overloaded backpacks. I saw ivy-covered red brick buildings named after people I'd never heard of, and men and women who must have been professors, mentally rehearsing their lectures as they walked quickly to class to teach things I would never know. The place felt rich, foreign, and mysterious, and so out of my reach that my chest clenched, and no matter how hard I tried to control them, the tears trickled down my cheeks. My husband stopped, stared at me, shocked. "What's the matter?" he said. "I never got to do this," was all I could say. "Then you should," he said. and minute, almost.
Stephanie Edelman has been in love with books all her life. A wife, mother, and grandmother, Stephanie is an assistant professor of English at Harding University in Searcy, Arkansas. Next on Tales from the South, it's not one but several decisions that Patrick Garner must make in a split second in Accidental Rudeness.
There are two things about me that are direct windows into my psyche. I am a communication teacher. My special interests are interpersonal and nonverbal communication. I'm also OCD. Now, if you think about it, that is a bad combination. It leads to innumerable social dilemmas. Consider the following scenario played and replayed in my mind years ago. I ran 5 miles a day, 5 days a week, always the same route. I mean, in Searcy, Arkansas, if you run 5 miles east or west, you run out of turf rather quickly. In the old days, my route always took me down Vine Street, past the county jail. Now, please remember, I am OCD, and I could not change my route. Periodically, I would run by the jail at noon. Inmates were out, seemingly unsupervised, loose on the street, cleaning the vehicles of the officers. Now, as a communication OCD-er, my dilemma was whether or not I should wave at the inmates as I ran by. My thoughts were as follows. If I run by and wave at them, they get angry at me for being free to run. They attack me and kill me. If I do not wave, they think I'm a rich running snob and they kill me anyway. Sorry, but this is the way my obsessive communication brain works. I live in a continuing Seinfeld episode. Over the years, I have especially obsessed about what to do in various awkward social situations. Now, those of you who are like me know what I mean. Actually, I am convinced that I have become a strange attractor for social weirdness. As such, I can think of two communication encounters that have molded my template for dealing with awkwardness. From these bizarre interactions, I have generated rules that help me navigate the minefield of social pretense. Several years ago, my family and I were returning from our annual August jaunt to Destin. We exited the interstate in Mobile, Alabama, stopping immediately at a quick stop before continuing the drive onto Hattiesburg. I pulled up in front of the store. My wife and children exited the vehicle. I stayed in there waiting for them to return. Now, in front of my car was the entrance to the one unisex bathroom of the store. As I was sitting in the car, an older woman walked in front of me and entered the bathroom. Now, what was so strange about this lady is that she reminded me of Edith Bunker. She was wearing a sweater in August in Mobile, Alabama, in the blazing heat. She looked mousy, sort of cowering with a Barney Fife demeanor. I forgot about her and continued to wait on the family. After several minutes, I decided I'd better go ahead and use the bathroom. I got out of the car, went over to the bathroom door, opened it, and was staring eye to eye with Edith. The stall door completely open, her legs splayed as she was in the process of applying toilet paper. I said all I could think of to say, "Oops," and quickly closed the door. Immediately thereafter, my family approached the car, animatedly chatting. My wife opened the passenger side door, and I immediately yelled at her, "Hurry up and get in." "Why? What's the matter?" she said. "Just get in and let's go." "What's the matter?" "I just walked in an old woman in the bathroom who was in the process of wiping herself, and I want to get out of here." Now, you have to remember that my wife is concerned over everyone's feelings. She always wants to make people happy, to solve their problems for them. And Edith was no exception. Mona Lee wanted us to wait for her to come out of the bathroom so she could counsel her about her bathroom trauma. But I would have none of that. Everybody knows that in situations of incredible embarrassment and awkwardness, especially involving bathrooms and nudity, you do not want to see the party involved in the interaction ever, ever, ever again. That's rule number one. I teach an honors class at Harding University entitled Human Situation 2. My second rule for dealing with awkwardness ironically flows directly from an incident that occurred several years ago in this very class. I was talking about the need for structure and non-structure in people's lives. I was relating my discussion to the Myers-Briggs test. The MBTI, as it is known, generates 4 of 16 different letter combinations to describe your specific personality. It so happens that my 4 letters are INTJ. I am introverted, intuitive, thinking, and judging. The last letter, J, or its opposite, P, describe a person's needs, high or low, for closure or structure in everyday life. My 4 letters are an accurate reflection of my personality and classroom persona. Despite being introverted, I am dynamic and enthusiastic in class, but I'm also serious, needing a high degree of structure and control. As I was waxing eloquent about Myers-Briggs, using myself as an example, I said, "Now take me. I'm very, very high J. I really need to increase my penis." How fast do you process thoughts about what you've just said? The books I have read speak in terms of milliseconds. My OCD brain was whirring. It was analysis in milliseconds, if that's possible. I realized what I had just said, and in the words of a dear friend, that is the worst nightmare come true. Immediately, I began to consider what I should do. I could ignore what I had just uttered and continue the lecture as if nothing significant or embarrassing had happened. But come on. This was not an unusual occurrence. It was both horrific and hilarious. To ignore it altogether would be to acknowledge that it was not unusual, an everyday experience in one of Dr. Garner's weird classes. Besides, I was looking right into the face of Benjamin Lamb, a bright and convivial student sitting on the front row. He was about to explode into laughter. He was trying to suppress it, but the tsunami was imminent. So, facing the inevitable, I exploded in gales of laughter. But there was another quandary I had to resolve. How could I control the dissemination of the story? I quickly realized that was impossible. What student in his right mind would not just die to repeat this gaffe made by the serious and sedate Dr. Garner? So, having acknowledged the awkward interaction in class, I decided to do a control burn. As soon as class was over, I immediately went down to the main office and coffee room, telling everyone who was there of my horrible life flash in the front of you encounter. Some weird interactions have to be acknowledged publicly and loudly, if for no other reason than to preserve your last shred of dignity. These are but 2 of the many rules that govern my interpersonal communication in awkward moments. After having seen both the practicality and mania of my mind, you might think I'm tempted to pull back from obsessing about propriety in communication. After all, I don't want to become a communication Nazi like the Seinfeld soup man. Nevertheless, I remain chastened by the wise words of Albus Dumbledore. Sadly, accidental rudeness occurs alarmingly often. As a matter of fact, that reminds me of the time I accidentally urinated in the wrong place in Addis Ababa, but that's another story.
Patrick Garner was born and raised in East Texas. He graduated from Harding University and has taught there for 43 years. He and his wife of 43 years, Mona Lee, have 4 children and 9 grandchildren. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Heath Carpenter makes a decision in the heat of the moment in A Power Mullet and Humble Pie.
Adam and I had been waiting for Finger for half an hour. and our patience had worn thin. We were meeting up at my house so we could all go ride to the outdoor basketball goals at the little church down Highway 36. We liked these goals because the rims were only 8 feet. Just short enough for vertically challenged white boys to be able to dunk. Just tall enough so that it wasn't too embarrassing. Finger's real name is Steven, but he earned the nickname Finger Roll because when we played on these short goals, he obstinately refused to dunk, though he was plenty tall and amply agile. He'd get his lanky arm above the rim and stretch out his hand, letting the ball gently dangle on his palm. At the last second, he'd whip his fingers back, moving against the ball's natural inertia, creating a spin that would dance spryly for a second or two on the rim and backboard before dropping through. It was all so dramatic. Finger roll got to be a bit too much of a mouthful, so after a while we just naturally shortened it to Finger. The South's known for such great nicknames. I've known guys named T-Bone, Hangdog, and Gizzard, and two named Frog. But Steven is the only man who answers to Finger. Adam and I decided to split. Only seconds into our drive, we saw the source of our time impediment. Old Finger had been pulled over for speeding on the highway. He had that flustered look on his face that folks get after such an event. Head cocked to the side, face sunk down in his left palm, elbow jutting out of the open window, vacant stare. We pulled up next to his car to give him the business and to let him know where we were going. Our exchange took mere seconds, yet the policewoman did not take kindly to our short visit. She hopped out of the patrol car and barreled across the road, pointing and shouting for us to pull over. We complied. Though short, she cut an imposing figure. She was stocky, with one of those late 80s, early 90s power mullets. It was short and curly on top and long and straight down the back. I've since pondered whether she curled the part on top or straightened the hair in the back. Or did the cut itself just naturally produce such seemingly incongruent hair chemistry? From the passenger side, I tried to explain, "Ma'am, we were just..." She was in no mood. "Shut your mouth," she hollered from behind aviator sunglasses. "You boys wait right here," she ordered, before whirling back around to her patrol car. What began as confusion fermented into fury as Adam and I sat stewing in his car in the sweltering Arkansas August heat for 45 minutes as Officer Mullet did Lord knows what in her patrol car. When she finally strolled back over to us with a ticket book in hand, any semblance of deference, patience, or goodwill had long since evaporated. "Officer, let me explain," I demanded with a tone of condescension. "Don't tell me my business, son. You should know better than to interfere with police work." "I wasn't interfering," I fired back. "Ooh, you have a smart mouth, son. What would your mama think about how you're talking to an officer of the law?" "Oh, no, she didn't." Beginning on the playgrounds of kindergarten, boys are trained to recognize that bringing up someone's mama is tantamount to fighting words. Now, technically, I knew the answer to her question. My mama would have told me to hush my smart mouth and say yes, ma'am, to the officer, no matter how ridiculous the whole event seemed. However, I altered my mama's would-be advice just a smidge. My mom would think this is the stupidest thing she's ever seen. The word stupid just hung out there, festering in the thick, humid air. I don't know what came over me. Ironically, stupid was one of my mother's most frowned upon words. "It's ugly and demeaning and should never be used toward another human being," she would say. Adam buried his head into his hands. The officer removed her aviators and glared at me while she slowly ripped up the ticket and began writing a new one. Boys, I believe I'm going to make it mandatory that you appear in court for obstruction of governmental operations. She handed me the ticket. And in a fit of thick-headed delirium, mustering smugness from the bottom of the dark side of my soul, I immediately crumpled it up and tossed it on the floor of the car, saying, "See you there." Before the ticket had a chance to hit the floor, the police officer flung the car door open and ordered me out. She whisked me toward the back of the car and plopped my chest down hard on the trunk, spreading my legs and searching me in the process. I glanced up across the road at old Finger, who had his mouth wide open in amazement and delight. This is what the Germans call Schadenfreude, taking pleasure in the discomfort of others. Bewildered, I wasn't sure what she was doing really, and truth be told, I don't think she really knew either. She was ticked, that was for sure, and she probably wanted to introduce my smart mouth to the business end of her nightstick, but she settled for this roadside pat-down before she hustled off, visibly flustered, leaving us for good. Well, basketball was certainly out of the question. The three of us went back to my house to ruminate on what had just transpired. My first phone call was to one of my best friends, whose dad happened to be the city attorney charged with prosecuting us. I had to get ahead of this thing before it got even more out of control. City attorney said, "Well, that's a pretty fantastic story, Heath." I didn't like the way he said fantastic. It wasn't in the "I can't believe she did that to you" way. It was more in the "Well, you've spun a pretty fanciful story here, young man." He was going to have to hear her version to get to the bottom of things. A few days before court, Adam and I were to talk with him again. He said for the most part, our stories checked out, and though he was certainly disappointed in my behavior, he thought the obstruction of governmental operations rap might be a little much. Ultimately, though, this would be the judge's call. He said, "Heath," looking me in the eyes, "when you're called up there, just shut your mouth. Don't be cute, and it'll probably all be all right." He was right. Peering down from over the top of his tortoise-rimmed glasses, sitting behind an elevated, stately wooden bench inside the old courtroom that seemed to be cut right out of a sepia-toned past, the judge let us off with a warning and a lecture on kibitzing and minding our own business. I glanced at Adam, thinking, "This is too easy." Because of my nerves, I had failed to realize that the police officer wasn't even there. She didn't show. I took this as a sure admission of defeat. We left the court elated, high fives, chest bumps, reeling off the perceived victory. We'd shown her. That night at home, my mom overheard our boasting. She let us carry on for a while until we had pretty much exhausted ourselves with self-congratulations. Then she calmly asked, "What do you think it's like to be a female police officer? Working long, often dangerous hours, for little money, in a male-dominated field, only to have a haughty, entitled brat challenge your authority with condescension and arrogance. And then to top it off, this brat uses the little political influence he can muster to get out of a ticket he probably deserved, casting doubt on your judgment in front of a judge and the city attorney, allowing that kid to feel that he can belittle another human being with no consequence. Now, how would that make you feel?" She paused, letting the rhetorical question fill the air. Like a deflated balloon rapidly losing its air, our imagined triumphant euphoria wheezed out of the room. She punctuated this lesson with words a son dreads. "You know better." My base instinct was to protest. But looking in the face of the woman who taught me about kindness, compassion, and empathy, I could only avert my eyes and stare at my feet in humiliated silence. Finger and Adam skedaddled out of there as fast as their legs could scoot. Though I never saw that hard-nosed policewoman again, my mother's disappointment instantly turned the whole fiasco into a metaphor of the power of an empathic mind, of the ability to see the world through another's eyes, and that ultimately arrogance is ignorance by another name. I'll certainly never look at a mullet the same.
Heath Carpenter is a father of four and husband to Hannah, a talented illustrator, Harding University English teacher, writer, and PhD student in heritage studies at Arkansas State. Heath is a lifelong Southerner who grew up in a family of hopeless storytellers. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience here at Harding University in Searcy, Arkansas, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Blackwater Hattie lived back in the swamp where the strange green reptiles crawled. Snakes hung thick from the cypress trees like sausage on a smokehouse wall, where the night was alive with a thousand eyes and all of them watching you. Stay off the track of Hattie's shack in the back of the Black Bayou. Way up the road from Hattie's shack lies a sleepy little overdroven sound. Talk of the swamp witch Hattie will lock you in when the sun go down. Rumors of what she done and rumors of what she do kept folks off the track of Hattie's shack in the back of the Black Bayou. One day the rain came and the rain stayed on and the swamp water overflowed. Fever and mosquitoes grabbed the town like a fist. Doc Jackson was the first to go. Now some said the plague was caused by Hattie. There was talk of a hanging too. But the talk got shackled by the howls and the cackles from the bowels of the Black Bayou. Dark and dawn, when shadows fill the sky, there came an unseen caller on a town where hope had run dry. In the square was found a big black round vat full of gurgling brew. Whispering sounds as the folks gathered round, it came from the Black Bayou. There ain't much pride when you're trapped inside a slowly sinking ship. They picked up the liquid and deep and green, and the whole town took a sip. The fever went away, and the very next day the skies again turned blue. Well, let's thank old Hattie for saving our town. We'll fetch her from the Black Bayou. A party of 10 of the town's best men headed for Hattie's shack. Said swamp witch magic was useful and good, and they're gonna bring Hattie back. Well, they never found Hattie, and they never found the shack, and they never took a trip back in. But a parchment note they found tacked to a stump saying, "Don't come looking again." Hattie Hill.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation, Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.